This is your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is supported by Tiger Fuel, homegrown since 1982. You can visit Charlottesville's only locally owned and operated chain of convenience stores today. They operate on Main Street, not Wall Street. Now your host, Rick Moore.
And thanks to everyone for being with us today here on 91.9 WNRN Charlottesville and Lexington's 95.3. I guess today I'm fascinated by this. I believe I originally called Dr. Paul Cantor back in May, maybe. Paul, is that correct?
That's right.
Back in May of this year to put this show together because of a title of his books. We'll be talking with Dr. Paul Cantor, who's a UVA professor of English, about the current book, the most recent book, The Invisible Hand in Popular Culture, Liberty versus Authority in American Film and TV. And it was the image for this specific book that got me all excited. The cover is of the painting, the Spirit of 76, you know, with the two drummers and the guy playing the, is he playing the flute? Is that the proper word for that?
Maybe
the fife, correct. Thank you. As they march along and the covers, one of the people is John Wayne. Another was Captain Kirk, and then Cartman from South Park.
Well, for legal reasons, I have to tell you that's not Cartman. It's a lookalike.
A lookalike, an image similar to Cartman. And then the previous book was called Gilligan Unbound. And so between all this, I'm like, that would be a really interesting conversation for me to have. So I write Professor Cantor, and we set it up from there. So that'll be our hour today, talking about pop culture and a variety of the things that go along with that. Talking about Martians and zombies and Westerns and Star Trek and a little bit about South Park as well. So welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
And real quick, for those, I've gotten a lot of feedback and questions about Lazarus, my dog Lazarus. Many people know that Lazarus had some health issues. Thank you so much for the caring that goes along with that. Lazarus is better than he was 10 days ago. There are still some issues involved with that, but that's what happens when you have a 12-year-old dog who's been whipped by a bear early in his life and starting to be a senior dog. But thanks for the care involved in the calls and the emails. So, Dr. Cantor, let's start right off. Invisible Hand in Popular Culture. Tell me about the book's title. Where does that come from?
Well, the phrase "the invisible hand" was made famous by Adam Smith, one of the early defenders of free markets, and refers to the idea that people are guided by an invisible hand. They don't need a government telling them what to do. If you just leave them to pursuing their self-interest, they will, by and large, do things for the public good. And I took that as an image for what I'm dealing with in this book, namely a lot of examples in popular culture that defend common people, basically suggesting that they can take care of themselves and that government intervention in their lives largely makes things worse. So I was trying to find the spirit of Adam Smith. By the way, his book, The Wealth of Nations, was published in 1776, the same date as that revolutionary image on the cover. So I thought it fit together well.
Wonderful. So we'll be talking about pop culture. Let's just jump right into one of these. I want to talk about Martians and zombies and how they fit into the pop culture scheme. There's an entire segment in your book devoted to the flying saucer movie and sort of the government ideology. And back in the 50s, what you're saying is that there was a lot of confidence in our greater good of the federal government, military, gathered scientists, not necessarily individuals, but a larger group of scientists coming together to do well for our individual general populace.
Right. I view the 1950s science fiction movies as very much a product of the Cold War. Threatened invasions from Mars were really an image for Soviet invasion, the communist threat, nuclear weapons being brought to our shores by bombers. And what's interesting about those films, by and large, is that they portray the average American as incapable of dealing with any kind of crisis. Very typical scene in these films is flying saucers show up and people go into a complete panic, and they need the police, the army, politicians, scientists to solve their problems. The chief film I discuss in that part of the book is Earth versus the Flying Saucers, and it really does reflect this sense that people are just helpless without a government to take care of them. Then I discuss this wonderful film from 1996 by Tim Burton, Mars Attacks, which completely inverts the polarities of the 50s films. In that film, the government is presented as completely incompetent. The scientists are almost in cahoot with the Martians. And Americans save themselves. And I'll use the term trailer trash because that's the way the film presents them. People who live in mobile homes, real redneck types, as it turns out, they're the ones who get together and defeat the Martians. And what I, not to spoil the film for people who haven't seen it, but the final thing that defeats the Martians is the music of Slim Whitman. And it doesn't get any more common touch than a yodeling country and western singer. And I just love the idea that a ragtag group of Americans gets together and accomplishes what the government failed to do. And it really just overturns the whole ideological bent of the flying saucer movie.
Rusty St. Prey, have you ever played Slim Whitman? Does that qualify as a...
That's classic country now.
So it just doesn't qualify as bluegrass anymore. Yodeling classic country, Slim Whitman defeating the Martians.
It blows their brains up, just to make it clear what happens.
I wonder where that idea comes from. Tim Burton obviously watched a lot of television in the 70s and remember seeing those TV ads for Slim Whitman LPs. So we're talking about... You know, Martians, and you talk about the 1950s movie sort of being pro-government. Where does that idea come from so that in the 1950s and then things, you know, 40 years later change in such a way? Why are we thinking that in the 50s that these movies come out?
Well, we're just come out of World War II, and I will grant that winning World War II is a good thing for America. And moreover, the way we want it demonstrated the ability of the government, for example, the Manhattan Project, the building of the atomic bomb, was very much on people's minds throughout the 50s, and that was taken as an example of what the government can accomplish. And then you had this Cold War atmosphere where people were so afraid of the communist menace, the Red Scare, and you had lots of propaganda in favor of atomic energy. There's this famous film, Our Friend the Atom, which anyone who went to school in the 1950s will remember being shown. And one point I actually made in the earlier book, Gilligan Unbound, but which applies here, with the fall of communism in 1989, that sense of an overwhelming threat was gone, and people began to feel they didn't have to rely as much on the U.S. government to protect them. And that's why in the 1990s, I discussed this in regard to the X-Files in my earlier book, but you see it in Mars Attacks, you begin to see people making fun of the government and questioning its abilities, because the sense is that there isn't the kind of threat there was so pervasively in the 1950s at the height of the Cold War.
So we don't have an outside threat. In the 50s, the threat was external, coming towards the U.S., and in the 90s, it sounds like what I'm hearing is, at least through popular culture, we still needed to have a threat or still wanted to have a threat, and it needed to be more of an internal threat. Concern.
Yes, and I have a chapter, it actually ends the book, which is on the alien invasion narrative in contemporary shows. And it's really interesting there that the aliens tend to be a image of our own government. I think of the show V. That's V for Victory. It only lasted two seasons, but it had aliens, but when they showed up, what they were promising was universal health care, what they called blue energy, and a public works program. And even at the time, people were really struck with how close this corresponded to then-candidate Obama's plans and promises to the American people. And I noticed this in a number of shows. Fringe would be another example. The Event would be another example. That these shows around 2010, 11, and so on, were shows where the aliens represented a kind of massive centralizing government project that would take over all of America. And what tends to be the source of resistance in these shows is private institutions. It was particularly striking to me in V that people who were religious, there's a Catholic priest in it, for example, represent the forces that stand up to this invading tyranny. It was, as I read it, it was any institutions that are a counterweight to the to a central government are praised in these shows, and above all, the family. It actually starts with The X-Files, but a lot of these shows portray an invading, all-pervasive force whose main goal is to destroy the nuclear family. And the main resistance against it comes from people's attachment to their families, to their local communities. It's very interesting to me that that became so pervasive. And you see it now, a current show like Falling Skies has the same setup.
It is 11:10 here on The Wake Up Call. Thanks for tuning in today. Our guest, Dr. Paul Cantor, he's a UVA professor of English, talking about his most recent book, The Invisible Hand in Popular Culture, a focus on liberty versus authority in American film and television. Again, on the cover, John Wayne, Captain Kirk, and a close proximity to Cartman from South Park, filling in the Spirit of 76 painting. Talking about Martians and zombies here in the first part of the program, you're welcome to call if you have a question or want to make a comment on pop culture throughout our hour, 434-979-0919. Brandon will answer the phone and put you through or take your question. Professor, we're talking about the flying saucer movies, especially of the 50s. Even then, you seem to sort of differentiate between the different style of movies. There's the one where the government is sort of the winning team over the Martians, the ones where it's the military who are saving the day. I think you use the phrase soulless communism. And then there's another where the scientists do it in a much more pacifist manner than the military. Let's do these sort of one by one. Earth versus Flying Saucers is your movie, where you talk about how ordinary people seem to be incapable of running their own lives. And so the government, the big federal government, has to step in and be the hero.
Right, and it's through a combination in that film of the government, its scientists, and the military. That's, to me, that's the classic film, and it's actually the one that Tim Burton had most in mind in doing Mars Attacks. And it really shows that it's like the Manhattan Project. Again, the government's able to put together a counterweapon to the I don't think they're actually from Mars in this case. I think they're from another solar system.
The aliens.
Yes, the aliens. So, we're able to take them out by sort of scrambling their messages and their guidance systems, and the flying saucers start to crash. One of them into the Capitol building, by the way.
And then we go on and Thing from Another World, another movie, is where you talk about the aliens sort of represent communism, where they're the soulless, S-O-U-L, soul, without a soul, the soulless representation of communism, where the military has to They would do it on their own.
Yeah, that film, by the way, that's the film most people would know simply as The Thing. It's one of the real classics from the 1950s. And in that film, there's a split in among the Americans fighting this invading flying saucer. And it's the scientist who is obsessed with communicating with the alien. And this is a great scientific opportunity. And he tries to prevent the efforts to destroy this being, but the military very wisely makes sure that we take care of James Arness, by the way, the guy who played Matt Dillon in Gunsmoke, because he's so tall, got to play the alien in this film. And the alien, he actually turns out to be a vegetable, and the thought about him is, yeah, that he has no emotions, and it's very much the way communists were being presented at the height of the Cold War in American ideology.
And then you go to the movie Day the Earth Stood Still, where the scientists save the day. The military makes some incorrect decisions early in the film, and so the scientists, and you use the word pacifist, come through.
Yeah, well, in this film, the alien is played by Michael Rennie, and he comes to deliver a message from all the other sentient planets in the galaxy. Earth has just developed nuclear weapons, and it's time to clean up things. Earth has finally become a threat to the universe, and Earth has got to get its act together, or the aliens from other planets will take over using robots like Klaatu, who's really the hero of the film. But it's very interesting because, again, the military in this movie is presented as bungling in the sense that it won't accept peace overtures from the alien. And a international group of scientists working, I think, through the UN tries to make peace with the invader. And Michael Rennie... Michael Rennie's the one who's named Klaatu. I forget the name of the robot. Michael Rennie delivers this amazingly pacifist speech. The film actually is an inheritor of the science fiction legacy of H.G. Wells. It was one of the great themes of H.G. Wells that scientists around the world had to band together and take over and rule the world for its own benefit. That's the great theme of the movie Wells made with Alexander Korda, Things to Come. And in that sense, Day the Earth Stood Still represents the peak of what I'm talking about, this notion that ordinary people can't run their own lives, but a scientific, technocratic elite has to run it for them.
Again, our guest today, Dr. Paul Cantor. He's a professor of English at UVA. His latest book, The Invisible Hand in Pop Culture, Liberty versus Authority in American Film and TV. And that's where we jump into the sort of the most recent. You talk about the inverted sense of these 1950s alien movies with Tim Burton and Mars Attacks, where the underclass is sort of presumed that they can't defend themselves in these 1950s movies, but Burton turns that upside down, and they're the only way to solve the problem.
Yeah, it really struck me when I first saw the film. It's almost a red state, blue state film. It captures perfectly the sort of Washington, D.C. elite and the kind of incestuous relations between the government and the media. Michael J. Fox plays a kind of CNN reporter in the film, and you really see the pretensions and the self-absorption and the narcissism of this kind of ruling elite, which again spans the government, the media, the scientists and intellectuals. And then you have what is presented in the film as the underclass, living in trailers, listening to country and western music, eating donuts, sending their sons into the military, the film really takes their side. They end up in Las Vegas and team up with Tom Jones, who plays himself in an amazingly great role. Tom Jones plays Tom Jones, and Tom Jones, again, a perfect, like Slim Whitman, a perfect example of the kind of entertainment that the Washington elite despises. Indeed, the film sets up Las Vegas as a kind of alternate capital of the United States to Washington, D.C., and Jack Nicholson plays the president in Washington, D.C., and a casino owner and land developer in Las Vegas. Does a great job, and really the secret message of the film is that they are the same sleazy character. But in any case, the film takes the side of all those aspects of American culture that are most despised by intellectual elites, and shows that these people living out in Kansas or visiting Las Vegas, they're really decent human beings. And they get along despite the government's thought that they can't take care of themselves.
This is Sunday Morning Wake Up Call on WNRN. Our guest today, Dr. Paul Cantor. We're talking about pop culture. Starting off with Martians and zombies.
Our members are joined by the following underwriters in their support of WNRN.
T&N Printing, serving Virginia since 1982. In addition to printing and copying, T&N specializes in construction document management, as well as dry mounting, binding, and mail services. T&N offers FSC-certified printing, an internationally recognized standard for production and consumption of forest products. T&N Printing can be reached at 434-971-8976 and t-nprinting.com. Atlantic Organic Natural Sleep Shop, featuring their natural and chemical-free organic sleep studio with environmentally conscious mattresses and bedding, including eco-friendly hardwood platform beds. That's Atlantic Organic, 421 West Main Street, Charlottesville. Website AtlanticOrganicSleepShop.com. It's bedtime naturally.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call, brought to you by the Markets of Tiger Fuel. You can visit Charlottesville's only locally owned and operated chain of convenience stores today. They operate on Main Street, not Wall Street. Now back to your host, Rick Moore.
And thank you for being with us today as we talk about pop culture. Talking with Professor Paul Cantor here in the studio. Professor Cantor, we're talking about the Martian, the alien-style movies. But one of the things I read that you had recently done sort of talks about zombies and the current zombie phase that we seem to be going through in our pop culture. And you say that this is more of a paraphrase. The world of zombies signifies the new American dream.
By that is that as horrible as the zombie situation is in the show The Walking Dead, which is mainly what I talk about, it restores people to a situation of self-reliance. What the essay you're referring to talks about is the fact that again and again in our pop culture now, we're seeing apocalyptic scenarios, end-of-the-world scenarios. And again, they're horrible. Again, maybe an alien invasion. It may be the loss of all the electricity in the world in revolution, or it may be the outbreak of a zombie plague. And again, I don't want to minimize how destructive these situations are, but there's a kind of fantasy at work at them in these, in that what these catastrophes produce is chiefly and foremost a dissolution of the federal government and all the institutions that run our lives today. And it shows people forced to go back to their own resources, and they, I won't say thrive, because again, the conditions are usually horrific, but they do develop a new sense of self-worth. It's really surprising, again, a show like Falling Skies with its alien invasion, or The Walking Dead, you see people deny the institutions they've been relying on, and so they fall back on homeschooling. They fall back on home health care. And these shows seem to suggest that that makes people come alive. It makes their lives more meaningful and exciting. And it shows Falling Skies is very interesting because the hero is a history professor, and it keeps referring back to the American Revolution and an attempt to recapture the spirit of that. The show Revolution had, obviously from the title, had the same idea. I think these shows reflect a concern and anxiety in our culture that we have lost the old American spirit of self-reliance and independence, and maybe it would take threatening times to bring that back.
Is it, we keep, or I use the phrase pop culture, is it popular or is it popularized? What does that refer to?
Well, I what do you mean by popularized there?
Well, by popular, if it's popular, that means, to me, that means that a whole lot of people like it. It gets high ratings. It made billions of dollars at the theater.
Yeah.
But popularized means that it might not have been so great in the beginning, but all the conversation about it sort of brought it to notice for people. You know, there was some event or somebody, something happened to make more people take notice of it, and that's how it slipped into the pop culture stream.
Okay, okay, now I see the distinction, and I think it's a legitimate distinction, and I'll say this, what we see on television, what we see in movies, some of it is genuinely popular, and some of it is popularized. It's not an either-or situation. I actually think, things that are popular, when we're talking about fictional dramas or comedies, I think usually they succeed because of some level of quality. But with these things like reality shows, I have to say I'm more skeptical of their value. And I think in their case, it may be more a case of our celebrity culture and things being popularized.
All right. Again, you're welcome to call in 979-0919. That's 434-979-0919. Talk with our guest today, Dr. Paul Cantor, which is how Michelle made it on the air. Good morning, Michelle.
Hello, and this is such a great topic. I'm just fascinated. I want to make sure, first of all, that I get the title of the book right, because I can't wait to read it. Is it The Invisible Hand in Pop Culture?
Yes, that's it, and it's available on Amazon.
Okay, I can't wait to read it. You've touched on some of my favorite TV shows, and not having cable, some that I wish I could see. But another thing, every time you talk about government, I keep thinking, I bet he's not related to Eric Cantor. Ha ha.
I'm not, in fact. But
then I wanted to just digress because I want to take advantage of your great mind. It took me years to run down I'm just about 64. It took me years to run down the title of a TV show that I remembered. Nobody had heard of it. I finally, after years of research, found out it was Johnny Jupiter. You know? Familiar with that one where...
I'm afraid I'm not familiar with that show.
...into some lab and hits the wrong button and tunes in a guy from another planet.
That happens a lot.
It was, you know, it was friendly.
I'm afraid I don't know that show. This is always a problem I have.
Well,
believe it or not,
so
I've not watched every television show.
I just wanted to very quickly see if I could pick your brain about an end-of-the-world disaster movie where at the sun is going nova or something to that effect, and there's massive floods on Earth, and the closing scene is this man and woman who just happened to meet each other, and the water's rising and the sun's coming up, and... Does that ring any bells with you for the title of that movie?
No, unfortunately, that's an awfully generic plot. I'll bet there's at least 10 movies that follow that formula. So I'm afraid I can't help you with that one.
All right, Michelle, what we'll do is we'll put the podcast up, and I'll ask people who that might ring a bell to see if we can reply that way.
But when my friends, you know, say science fiction, I'm like, do you realize how many things you take for granted, the tech that's come out of those movies, because of this saying, if you can think it, you can invent it. And, you know, there are a lot of scientists out there that have gleaned little seeds from science fiction, and everyday people using stuff don't realize, you know, where the idea came from. So can't wait to read your book, and thanks for a great discussion here.
Well, thank you for calling.
Thanks, Michelle. Thanks for the call. 434-979-0919. Phone lines open now for our conversation with Dr. Paul Cantor, professor of English at UVA. And again, the book is The Invisible Hand in Popular Culture. Liberty versus Authority in American Film and TV. You can find it on Amazon.com. Professor, we were talking about aliens and zombies, and sort of that leads us to Star Trek, which takes us back to Westerns. I found that pretty fascinating. You talk about the final frontier of Star Trek actually came from an earlier frontier being the West.
Yes, I was really struck by one fact that when I had a one of my favorite shows as a kid was Have Gun Will Travel, starring Richard Boone as Paladin. Started, I think, in 1957 and ran for 5 or 6 years. When it finally came out on DVD, I started watching episodes and saw that Gene Roddenberry had written many of them. In fact, he wrote 26 of the some 200 episodes that the show ran. And Gene Roddenberry, of course, is the creator of Star Trek. And I thought, can there be any relation here? Western science and a science fiction story. And I started looking at the episodes Gene Roddenberry wrote, and there it was. There was Star Trek already. That is, Paladin was a kind of hired gun. He would wander the West cleaning up towns. And I realized the basic premise of the series, Have Gun Will Travel, was that Americans couldn't take care of themselves. That anywhere you went east of California, and specifically of San Francisco, you found small towns run by crooked sheriffs and corrupt businessmen, and Paladin had to come in and straighten things out during his work week and go home and party in San Francisco on the weekends. And I realized this was just Hollywood's view of America, that out there between the coasts was some vast wasteland, a sink of iniquity, and only right-thinking people from Hollywood, from California, could go out and clean things up. And then I saw this was just the pattern of Star Trek, except instead of the small towns, it had other planets. Captain Kirk and Mr. Spock would go around the universe, and any time they found a planet that didn't look like 1960s America, they'd remake it, especially if it had something like a theocracy, if it had people who believed in a god, or if it had some kind of race ruling another race. Then the Americans had to clean it up.
We have another call. Let's see, call from Douglas. Good morning, Douglas.
Good morning, gentlemen. I find the conversation very timely. When you guys opened the program, there was a conversation about these early movies and their link to science kind of fostering society. I think specifically about a movie called The China Syndrome and its effects on culture when it was released, and more importantly, the desensitizing effect that it has today. We are living in these times, and it seems as though it's going unchecked. We're 2 years, 4 months out, and what a group of people have been saying for this period of time is now in mainstream media, and it's still not being discussed. Could you discuss with the audience the desensitizing effects that these movies from Hollywood have?
All right, thanks, Douglas.
Well, I disagree with you. I would call them sensitizing. I mean, my whole point about these movies and these television shows is they have a lot more intellectual content than people think. They actually do help make people aware of issues. I'm not even quite sure what you mean by desensitizing here. I know there's the thesis that movies desensitize people to violence, and I can see some truth to that. But I also think they have made people more sensitive to a lot of issues.
Well, we're going to get in, not specifically to this, but a little later in the hour, so don't go anywhere, we're going to be talking about South Park. And you do talk about how that desensitizes people to one part of life so that the comments from the people at South Park can get through, correct? And I want to go into great detail about this because it's a little, I don't want to get too far away from
again,
where
we are. Again, I'm having trouble with the word desensitize here. That I just don't agree with the word desensitize.
All right. Again, it's 11:32 here on the wake-up call. our guest today, Dr. Paul Cantor. He's a professor of English at UVA. His book, The Invisible Hand in Pop Culture, is what we're talking about this morning. Martians and zombies, and now we're getting into Westerns and Star Trek. And we're going to let the professor talk about how that takes us to President John F. Kennedy in just a moment.
Today's programming on WNRN is supported by
locally owned Rudy's Cleaners in Pantop Shopping Center near Food Lion, Route 250 East at the foot of Pantop's Mountain. Rudy's Cleaners can assist you with shoe repair, alterations, laundry and dry cleaning services, specializing in curtains and drapes. Online at SeavilleShop.com/Pantops.
Hi, I'm Bob Campbell from the UVA Hospital Auxiliary Volunteers. Each year we award over $30,000 in scholarships to students pursuing careers in healthcare. You can help support these scholarships by joining us for SIPs and Sunsets for Scholarships. This wine tasting event will be held at the Prince Michelle Wine Shop atop Carter's Mountain, overlooking Charlottesville, on Friday, September 13th. From 6:30 to 9:30 p.m., you'll be able to enjoy wine, live music, and light refreshments. For more information, please call 434-924-5251. I'm Bob Campbell from the UVA Hospital Auxiliary Volunteers, making a community connection on WNRN.
Make your community connection with WNRN. Email connection at WNRN.org with your nonprofit event or organization's information. Independent Music Radio, WNRN.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call, brought to you by the Markets of Tiger Fuel. Now back to your host, Rick Moore.
And thank you so much for being here with us today. And caller, are you with me? Hello, hello? No? All right. So I'll let Brandon take care of that. So, Professor, we were talking about Westerns leading us to Star Trek and sort of the representation of where that goes. Hang on. So we do have Tom. I was just a little too impatient. Tom, you with me?
Yes.
Your question for Dr. Cantor, or your comment?
Yes. Speaking of science fiction, as far as George Lucas's Electronic Labyrinth, where would the dichotomy be between something like Electronic Labyrinth and Star Trek or Star Wars?
I actually don't know what Electronic Labyrinth is. I'm sorry.
Okay, it's the student film to THX.
I know THX vaguely, but I really can't answer your question.
Okay.
All right, Tom. Thanks. All right. So again, you're welcome to call 434-979-0919. It sounds like getting too specific with specific films may not be the way to go, but topics in general, feel free to call in and participate. So, Professor, we were talking about how a Western-style show takes us to Star Trek, where in Star Trek, the hero of Captain Kirk sort of represents the hero in the Westerns, where you shoot up the bad guys to protect the weak people.
Exactly. And the interesting thing is, well, his name was James Tiberius Kirk, and that has a certain ring like John Fitzgerald Kennedy. And my argument in that chapter is that the new frontier that John Kennedy spoke of was related back to the old frontier of the American West and forward to the final frontier of Star Trek. And that you really see how important the frontier has been in American history and in the presentation of the American spirit. And so there was a kind of cowboy aspect to Kennedy's public image. And also you have the fact that the Star Trek was a kind of Cold War show. The most amazing thing about Star Trek to me was the Prime Directive. Supposedly the Prime Directive was the United Federation of Planets would never intervene in the affairs of another civilization. And yet, episode after episode, that's what the Starship Enterprise did. Come in and take apart whatever regime was in place on a planet they encountered. And that struck me as very parallel to American foreign policy during the Cold War, during the 1960s in particular, that America was going to become the policeman of the world and spread democracy around the world. And wherever it encountered anti-democratic forces, it was going to go and fight against them. And that's very much the spirit of Paladin in Have Gun Will Travel and the spirit of Captain Kirk in Star Trek.
Right. It's sort of the less government, not ours, but less government from these other countries, from these other planets, gives you more freedom. Except at home, we need more government to ensure our domestic freedom.
Exactly. Exactly. That's the logic that I detected in the two shows.
But then you also go into, while you're discussing Westerns, and it seems to carry over to Star Trek as well, is that you talk about The Searchers, a movie, and you talk about how freedom can be, I think this is your phrase, freedom can be deeply problematic.
Yeah, that's at the heart of the book. That is, I'm very interested in representations of freedom in American films and television, but also many films and television shows show the problematic side to freedom, the thought that freedom produces disorder, that it produces chaos, that it produces anarchy. That's the great fear that's represented in so many disaster films, that if you take away the institutions that normally govern people's lives, they will turn into cannibals. Remember at the time of Hurricane Katrina, there were these weird rumors taken as fact by the national media that acts of cannibalism were going on in New Orleans. I think even in the Superdome they were claiming that people were killing each other in the Superdome. All this turned out to be false. There's a wonderful book by a woman named Rebecca Solnit called Paradise Built in Hell, which shows again and again this disaster narrative that people think take away the police for 24 hours and all hell will break loose. And occasionally that has happened in some cities affected by riots. But as Solnit points out, in the majority of cases, people band together and learn to take care of themselves.
We got a call from Kelly, and again, I'm not sure where this particular question falls into the specifics versus commentary. Kelly isn't sure about if this is the proper name. The Phantom Empire with Gene Aubrey, are you familiar with that?
Vaguely. Again, I apologize to people out there, but in a sense, I have to admit, I haven't seen every film and television show. I really would urge people, if they want to ask about the things I'm talking about, I can be responsive, but I vaguely remember that as some kind of serialized Western or something, but I really can't talk about it.
Well, let me bring in a question. We're talking about, the Western of Have Gun Will Travel, Star Trek, and how that plays into, sort of the political goals or thoughts of the John F. Kennedy presidential group. Let's talk about current events now, because you seem to have two different people who have done two different things. We have Edward Snowden, who has let forth the NSA, and it has brought forward a conversation about personal privacy. And then you have Bradley Manning, who on WikiLeaks put forth all this information that was considered, should this be public knowledge? So we have personal privacy versus public information. Do you see where these might at any point be put forth? They might fill up the popularized culture and bring out their own series of movies or television shows?
Well, in fact, it's already happened. I mean, all these things that have come out through Snowden and Manning, the X-Files was dealing with in the 1990s. In a certain sense, I didn't feel surprised by any of these so-called revelations. I've assumed all along that the NSA and other government agencies were listening to every phone call made in the United States, tracking every email made in the United States. That's certainly what the X-Files portrayed already in the 1990s. It's a great theme of one of my favorite TV shows recently, Fringe. I would say that one of the things I most admire in American popular culture in the past two decades is that it has confronted this issue of the surveillance state. Again and again, you see in movies and television shows the idea that the government is tracking everything. The show Person of Interest would be another example right now. Its suggestion that there are cameras everywhere and you can spot anything anyone's doing at any given moment. I think American popular culture can take a lot of credit even before these recent revelations. It was showing what's deeply troubling about the amount of government surveillance going on.
Again, our guest today, Dr. Paul Cantor, UVA professor of English. His new book, Invisible Hand in Popular Culture, Liberty versus Authority in American Film and TV.
WNRN thanks the following for their support of independent music radio.
Boudoir Lingerie Boutique in the Boonesboro Shopping Center, Lynchburg. At Boudoir, you can find Bridal by Jane Woolrich, Intimate Apparel by Blush, and Oulala Cherie, plus maternity, lingerie, and loungewear. Boudoir is your dressing room and carries sizes AA to H at 4925 Boonesboro Road, Lynchburg, and votreboudoir.com, VOTREBOUDOIR.com.
All right, thanks back to Sunday Morning Wake Up Call here on WNRN. Just want to let you know that tickets for the Lock-In Music Festival are available, featuring Further with Phil Lesh and Bob Weir, the Trey Anastasio Band, John Fogerty, Widespread Panic, Grace Potter, Jimmy Cliff, String Cheese Incident, Government Mule, and more on sale now. Lock-In Music Festival is donating a portion of every ticket sold through the WNRN.org website to us, independent music radio, WNRN. So just click through the Lock-In Music Festival banner at our website and use the promo code WNRN when you buy your tickets to the music festival. It's coming to Nelson County pretty soon, September 5th through the 8th, and you'll be making a donation to us at WNRN. Black Crows, Punch Brothers, Keller Williams, and more. Get your tickets at WNRN.org. All right, back with our guest, Professor Paul Cantor. Paul, one of my favorite parts, again, we talk about the cover of your book, Invisible Hand in Popular Culture. You have the Spirit of 76 painting, the Drum and Fife group, and the cover has John Wayne as one of the characters, Captain Kirk is another, and something that looks really reasonable facsimile of Cartman from South Park. So let's talk about South Park for a minute. Because it seems to take down the program, or the show as you put forth, takes down both sides of our political aisle. It's strongly libertarian.
Yes, and so it manages to offend both liberals and conservatives. A good example would be the episode.
Now watch our language. Yeah. Again, because your book has a few dirty words in this,
yes,
in this area, as they do on the program.
I will be very careful. Yes, my book should have at least a PG rating. Let's be honest about that. But there's an episode that takes up the issue of homosexuals as Boy Scout leaders. And it very much defends homosexuals and makes fun of people who are prejudiced against them. And in that sense, it might offend conservatives. On the other hand, at an amazing turning point in the episode, the character who's been turned down as a Boy Scout leader because he's gay defends the right of the Boy Scouts to make its own rules. And he feels that part of freedom is freedom of association, and that in turn would offend liberals. This has led some people to say that South Park just is nihilistic and doesn't have any position, but in fact it has a consistently libertarian position. It reminds us that we so often think of a simple spectrum in politics in America that runs for from liberals to conservatives. Libertarians are left out of the picture. Example, libertarians are generally pro-gay rights, which would be a liberal position. On the other hand, they're against government enforcement of gay rights, which would be a conservative position. So South Park is really quite amazing in American popular culture for its willingness to stake out a consistent libertarian position.
But as you write about early on in your time watching South Park, it was the vulgarity that comes through in the most obvious sense, and it took you a while to dig deeper.
Yes, by one of those accidents of history, every time I tuned into the show, it was a Mr. Hankey episode. Fans of the show will know what I'm talking about, but I won't talk about it on radio.
Well, I think we can say poop.
Poop. Okay, yes, Christmas poo. Anyway, I was not amused. But I, you know, my students were so interested in it, and I heard so many good comments about it, that I forced myself to watch it more, and then began to see that the show actually stakes out a very interesting political position. And I did come to realize that the consistent use of profanity has a basis in culture. You find it way back among the ancient Greeks and Aristophanes. Comedies. You see it in Chaucer, you see it in Shakespeare, in American literature, you see it in Mark Twain, that use of profanity is intellectually liberating. It breaks a set of taboos and prepares you for breaking a set of taboos in a deeper way.
Well, now, not to take your train of thought, but isn't this what Douglass was talking about? Desensitizing?
Well, I see, again, I don't think desensitizing is the right word for this. Again, desensitize, you see a lot of violence that desensitizes you to violence and maybe makes you more likely to commit violence. I personally doubt that. There's the other view that this is cathartic, that seeing violence gets the violent impulses out of your system. But this is more an intellectual process of deconventionalizing you, getting you to break out of conventional ways of thinking. Maybe the problem is I'm a professor and I do tend to approach things in intellectual ways. But that's what I think is going on in South Park.
11:50 here on the Wake Up Call, Sunday morning, WNRN. Our guest, Dr. Paul Cantor, professor of English at UVA, talking about pop culture, his most recent book, The Invisible Hand in Popular Culture, Martians and Zombies and Aliens, Western, Star Trek, John F. Kennedy, and now he's tied to Captain James T. Kirk. Now, South Park. Now, one of the things that I have to admit, I'm much more of a Simpsons fan than a South Park fan, although I will admit Simpsons has sort of gone on a downward slope in terms of its humor and interest in the shows, but I still do my DVR recording every week. But you talk about South Park and how it at the end of it, almost every show, it gets into a serious, covering a serious conversation, and whether that is assisted suicide, sexual harassment, foreign policy. And so if you can get through the vulgarity, I think you use the word philosophy.
Yes, it really is a thoughtful show, and it tends to approach issues in a thoughtful way and really think them through. I discuss in my chapter on South Park two of the episodes that deal with big corporations. I guess I can say Starbucks and Walmart, even though on the show they slightly disguise the names. And the episode shows how contrarian the show is. It's a standard narrative in American popular culture that corporations are evil and big corporations are more evil. But this show demonstrates that a corporation's okay if it's delivering a product people like, as in the coffee in Starbucks, or delivering products cheaply, as in Walmart. And the interesting thing is that in both episodes, South Park shows that the real opposition to these corporations is not really in the public spirit, but it's from other corporations. In the Harbucks episode, as it's called, the name of the episode is Gnomes, as I recall. But in any case, there, it's a local coffee shop that covertly riles up the town against Harbucks and tries to get their coffee banned. That's a real insight into, I think, a lot of stuff that's going on in American society.
All right, apparently I mentioned the name, and the phone comes back. Douglas, back on the phone. Douglas, your follow-up comment or question?
Yeah, when I was speaking earlier of desensitization, I'm not speaking about violence. And it's important to draw the distinctions between Hollywood's version of the China Syndrome and actuality today. In the movie China Syndrome, there's the expression of technology, the results of that technological failure, the effects on society, and the resolution of issues. If you take Fukushima today, it seems as though technology is off of the table. Nobody's spoken about LIDAR radar imagery of Japan. Nobody's talking about studies of radiation and toxicity in the oceans. We're 2 years and 4 months late on something that was sold to America 30 years ago as a movie, and we're not paying attention. The desensitization is that the movie made it clear to everybody that the technology was in hand, and it's not. That's the desensitization that I'm talking about.
Hey, Douglas, let me pop in here real quick, and then I'm going to let Dr. Kanter answer your question, and I'm going to let you go. But for whatever reason, I guess just basic interest, I turned on the new Al Jazeera American news channel, and the first show that I saw, granted, this is not CNN or ABC, but the first show that I saw on the new Al Jazeera American was them doing a report from China of a gentleman walking around in his neighborhood near these melted down nuclear reactors, testing the, you know, with his little reactor and doing a test in the oceans, etc. So granted, China Syndrome was a long time ago, and now we're talking about it after the fact, but it is out there by some. It is not a major issue, granted, to the extent that you seem to want, but it is. It hasn't been overlooked by everyone. Some, maybe you need to, or maybe we as a people need to find it. I'm going to let Dr. Kanter go on, all right?
Well, let me just say that I agree with you that we're not paying enough attention to what happened in Fukushima. But I would disagree with you. I think China Syndrome was an attempt to alert people to the problem of nuclear power plants. It was an irony of history that shortly after that, almost immediately after that, I think even while the film was in first run, we had the Three Mile Island disaster.
And all the Jackson Brown, you know. Yeah.
So, again, we can argue about it. I see your argument that if the film shows the problem contained, then it makes people less concerned about the issue. But the counter argument could be made, and it's the argument I would make, was the film was an attempt to alert people to the problems of nuclear power. And, of course, the phrase China Syndrome passed into the language immediately at the time of the Three Mile incident.
And Douglas, I'll tell you, I'm always looking for shows, show topics, show guests. Send me an email, rmoore@wnrn.org, and let's put together a one-hour conversation on this. All right, Dr. Kanter, just a few minutes left, 11:56 here on Wake Up Call, WNRN. Let's go back to South Park for a few minutes because, you know, Douglas is talking about a deep topic. But is this something that we've seen on South Park? Have we seen them talking about what happened in Japan? Have we seen them talking about the media overlooking and scarcely touching on important topics of the world?
Well, it's certainly, South Park certainly deals with, media biases. I will say that by and large, its approach has been the opposite. It has, in effect, criticized the disaster syndrome of the media. There have been episodes about global warming that suggest the threat is much exaggerated and that, so-called responses to global warming are worse than the problem itself. So it's a difficult issue with the media. Sometimes they underplay problems, sometimes they overplay them. Certainly South Park has gone after Al Gore and his becoming a celebrity on the basis of warning the world against impending disasters. There's the whole Man Bear Pig episode that is a beautiful treatment of that subject. I give South Park credit for showing the other side of this problem.
Yeah, because it does seem to attack political correctness.
Oh, absolutely, and that's what makes it so amazing. One argument I make in the chapter is that comics lost out with the increasing permissiveness in our culture about sex, that it used to be you could get a lot of laughs just by saying anything vaguely related to sex, and now that's no big deal. But as I put it in my book, sex is no longer taboo, but sexism is. And so it started, I think, with Seinfeld. But South Park has shown there's a lot of humor to be mined by making fun of the absurdities of political correctness.
And another 60 seconds or so, one of the things that caught my interest that you wrote was that being critical, again paraphrasing, being critical of your country is not unpatriotic, at least through the South Park vision.
Yes, and the X-Files vision as well, and many of these shows, it's always been the American tradition that we're free people and we have the right to free speech and we should be able to speak our minds. And that's why I try to suggest with the cover that there's a continuity between American popular culture and the spirit of 76, the spirit of revolution.
Again, our guest today, Dr. Paul Cantor. He's a professor of English at University of Virginia. His book that we've been discussing, The Invisible Hand in Popular Culture, you can find it on Amazon. And that's Paul Cantor with a C, C-A-N-T-O-R. Professor, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. And if you didn't hear enough, I'm on C-SPAN 2 at 1:20 today talking about the book for 17 minutes.
Wow, great. Radio and television all at one time. When's the movie? All right.
I can't wait.
Next week will be entertainment with the folks from Big Blue Door. It'll be some storytelling. We did this last year. A lot of positive feedback. So some storytelling, comedy, drama, personal insights. Thanks, everybody. Enjoy your Sunday.
This has been your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is supported by the markets of Tiger Fuel, homegrown since 1982. You can visit Charlottesville's only locally owned and operated chain of convenience stores today. They operate on Main Street, not Wall Street. Views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the management, staff, or board of WNRN. You can contact Rick at abstractme@aol.com or wakeupcall@wnrn.org. The Wake Up Call is produced by Angie Cruz. Tune in next Sunday morning at 11 for The Wake Up Call, only on WNRN.